Hello, this is Father Gregory Pine, and welcome back to the Thomistic Institute podcast for this off-campus conversation, where we follow up with the Thomistic Institute speaker apropos of a lecture or a contribution to an intellectual retreat or something else besides, so as to continue the conversation. So for this installment, I'm very delighted to be joined by Professor Joshua Hochschild. Thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here, Father.
So as it turns out, you are one of the more popular Thomistic Institute speakers. You speak on a variety of themes, on a variety of subjects, which people find interesting. I'm trying to get people interested in the things that I like talking about. It's like the Philadelphia 76ers and the plight of the perpetual loser. But very few people seem willing to take me up on that offer. But for those who may not have heard you on the Thomistic Institute podcast or encountered you in your various publications on things ranging from Cajetan on analogy to everything else under the sun. Would you just say a word of introduction, who you are, where you're from, and what you
sure.
do?
Yeah, I live in Maryland. I have been teaching at Mount St. Mary's University in Emmitsburg for 19 years. I'm a convert to Catholicism. I studied medieval philosophy at the University of Notre Dame as someone who was interested in Catholicism, but at the time I was not Catholic. Just had a lot of friends who were Catholic and was really interested in the development of medieval philosophy and especially the role of Thomas Aquinas. I've continued doing sort of scholarly research in medieval philosophy, but both as a teacher and more recently, more as a speaker and writer. I've found myself writing on really anything that I can connect to the Catholic intellectual tradition. Which I think is capacious enough to include a lot of things. So I've written on, issues of Catholic higher ed, of Catholic social teaching, writers that have influenced me like John Henry Newman, Alistair MacIntyre, Wendell Berry, and just topics that I'm interested in. But also sometimes I'm asked questions by students who invite me to speak and it's not a topic that I had thought about before, but I've welcomed the occasion to give a new talk. So I think my first talk for the Thomistic Institute was about Sartre, and I hadn't read him since I was in a college class. And one of my more recent talks, the students gave me the title, Do Trees Have Souls? And I had never written about whether trees have souls. I mean, I've studied Thomistic biology, psychology. So I knew a kind of glib answer to that question. But I enjoy anywhere that people are asking questions to connect them to what I think is the best tradition of making those questions coherent and finding answers to them. So
yeah. There's a sense in which our life's work is to refine the asking of questions, not just in the sense of like the defeatist psychologist who sits back in his chair and reposes to you the things that you yourself have formulated in genuine earnest, but in the sense of like, well, if you ask better and better questions, the chances are that you might get better and better answers. So, I want to follow up then. You mentioned a couple of things which are pertinent to the subject. One is, Catholic social teaching. The other is Wendell Berry. So I thought that we might talk just a little bit about the environment. And maybe it's good at the outset to acknowledge that some people, in hearing that we're going to talk about the environment, are inordinately avid in their interest or inordinately nonplussed. And I find that this is often the case with things that have become polemical, is that like we just are kind of exhausted in the 21st century. And in part, that's because of how the discourse has played out in the public square. It's like, person X says thing Y, so person X prime says thing not Y. That's way more complicated than it needed to be. But like, we just define ourselves against and we find ourselves in dread battles where we're not actually engaging with like principles or rehearsing arguments or even inquiring into the subject. So I don't know, maybe in your experience as a teacher or in your research into potentially controversial items, how do you motivate interest without kind of getting bogged down in unhelpful polemics or otherwise unfruitful conversations?
That's a good question and applies to a lot of different things. I mean, when people have strong opinions and they're strident about it, there's a danger, but there's also an opportunity. I mean, it means they have to care about something and it means that they are grasping onto certain ideas that help them articulate what they care about. And even if those are limited categories, even if their care is somewhat inordinate or disordered, you know, you can use that and seek for the good in it, and you can challenge the categories and find ways to reformulate. When I'm teaching in the classroom, I teach undergraduates and I also teach seminary students. I'm not the kind of teacher who thinks it's his job to like hide his views or always seem like he's above the fray. My students typically have a pretty good sense of who I am and what my convictions are. But I think almost because of that, I can easily set a tone where I can show that I'm not afraid to hear other ideas, that I'm willing to give credit to alternative perspectives and find truth in ways of putting things that maybe wouldn't be the way that I would put things. And I think what I find in general is that students are very, very hungry for occasions where ideas can actually be shared, and it's not just an occasion of exercise of power and manipulation. So if they can feel like they're heard, if they can feel like someone is listening and actually thinking about what they're saying and not just responding with pat answers and slogans, I find that students are actually very willing to discuss hard issues, even issues on which they might disagree, issues that feel neuralgic because they are polarized in the popular culture. That just depends on being a good listener and being skilled at hearing and formulating and sometimes reformulating questions so that students don't feel like they're stuck or like they're merely rhetorical questions, but they are a genuine invitation to further reflection.
Yeah, no, it's interesting as you describe kind of practically, well, speculatively and practically how to approach that. I'm reminded too, like you're a humble man and you're also a kind man, which I also think commends the discourse. I often say like humility is an old man's virtue. Perhaps that's a way by which to excuse myself for not having cultivated to this point. But like it strikes me that when you're patronizing, condescending, and or smug, it's like good luck. It's just nigh unto impossible because this is something that we sometimes lose sight of, but the virtues aren't just like the fruit of discourse. They are the means. I mean, sure, that's to speak of them in ways that people might find problematic, but you can't really host the discourse except for certain. I mean, McIntyre makes this point with respect to practices, you know, like you have to become worthy of the goods for which you strive within the setting of the actual practice itself. Otherwise it's like, I mean, what are we doing here? It's just like a formal exercise in what? So I'm thinking just specifically then about the work of Wendell Berry. You've spoken on him in a variety of settings, I suppose. But the kind of gaze that he casts on the environment, it seems like a kind of transfigured gaze insofar as the environment presents itself to Wendell Berry and he turns to you with a kind of, you know, visage wherein you recognize that he's seen something, you know, something that you may perhaps not have seen. And he's not just being kind of romantic in his descriptions or exotic in his flights of fancy. There's something there. So maybe, I don't know if you could just describe a bit your encounter with him and then how he kind of puts you in touch with these types of questions or these types of realities.
Sure. No, I think you put that really well. There is something about the way that he sees the world around him that invites you in to try to share that vision or at least learn from it. I think a lot of people feel that they can't share it, but even so, they're intrigued by it. Part of it is that he's made a choice to live in a certain relationship with the land. He could have been a rootless academic like most of us who talk about him, but he went back to his family and community and land, and he's farmed for most of his life, and that gives him a perspective on the land. But also I think it's that it has been very natural to him to have I don't think I've ever found him calling it this, but Catholic thinkers who are often very attracted to Wendell Berry would call his vision a sacramental vision. So he sees creation not as just dead stuff not as just something mechanistic, not as something merely to be used, but he sees it as an expression of a meaningful cosmos, and as active and alive, and something that he is humbled to participate in. So, you know, when he's talking about planting a field, to him, that is a kind of pregnant metaphor for all kinds of other human activity in the family. It's a metaphor for marriage, but it's also a metaphor for what it is, you know, to steward a patrimony and to be a member of a tradition. And so I think another part of what is attractive about Wendell Berry's vision is, while it's often rooted in the land, and he's funny for as a philosopher for talking about soil. I was going to say dirt, but he would correct me. He talks about soil. But he has a very integrated vision, and he's very good at articulating not just what he sees, but how the different things that he sees are connected and related to each other. And that, I think, is why he's been so widely influential. He's also he's avoided being boxed in or pigeonholed or labeled as belonging to one party or another, or one ideological tribe or another. And he has been very, very influential on theologians, and especially Catholic theologians. He's not a Catholic, but some of the ways that he speaks, I think, have helped remind Catholics about the resources of their own tradition. And all of those things, I think, play together in the different modes that he communicates. So, you know, many of your listeners might know, but he's a writer, an essayist. I was introduced first to his essays, but he's also a novelist, and he's also a poet. He's a very versatile voice who uses words to communicate deep spiritual sense about the cosmos. And he's very effective at that, and he's tapping into something very deep.
Okay, so I think I want to follow up with this idea of, right, you're describing sowing seed, and then the way in which that kind of opens us up, I suppose, to a more rich encounter with family life, you know, with the sacrament of marriage, with, you know, social and political life, or with, you know, like even ecclesial life beyond that. And how the simple kind of gestures, as it were, not to say that, like, to the degree or extent that we are closer to the land, we are thereby in closer touch with our human experience. I mean, some people might push back against that. But just simply to say that when we are attentive to nature, right, that it affords us an entry into, or it affords us an appreciation of, other things in life that issue from it. So I'm just thinking here about, like, the fecundity of nature, the fact that, like, nature begets life, and this association that, you know, ancient medieval philosophers and theologians have made between, you know, nature and being born, like natus est or nativitas, this idea that a nature is a principle both of what a thing is and what a thing's for, or like what it is and where it's going. And so, yeah, just thinking this in terms of the environment or the land, I think, like, in a lot of conversations, you have the industrialist on the one side who says, let's just kind of take what we need and then move on. If it suffers, then we'll, like, plant trees in another place. And then you have the environmentalist who seems skeptical that we can make any positive contribution. You know, like, the best that we can do basically is to leave it alone. Where it seems like, yeah, this idea that you're proposing, that nature gives us insights which should be, like, drawn out, teased out, or ultimately unfolded in a human setting, that there's, like, a relationship that can arise. Can you speak to that, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll put it this way. Often when you hear a case for care of the environment made, it will be made in terms that are familiar from essentially from modern liberal political theory. So we'll talk about whether the environment has rights, or what rights we have to use the environment in one way as opposed to another. And, you know, I mean, maybe there's some value in using that language sometimes, but I think rights is probably kind of a red herring when it comes to talking about the environment. And a better frame would be to talk about the kinds of virtues that we should be cultivating, including basic virtues of recognizing our place in relation to others in the cosmos. So, you know, there are, I think, matters of justice when it comes to the environment, and certainly matters of prudence. And, you know, the world outside of our buildings, the, you know, nature out there, it's not a garbage dump for us to just use and trash. But it's also not a paradise that's already perfect and is marred by any contact with human shaping. It's a garden. It is given to us to be used and to be used well. And we can't be too proud and overconfident about our ability to control nature. But at the same time, we can't be too timid or fearful to enter into a relationship with nature and learn to understand it and appreciate it better. And, you know, that seems to me to be the kind of perspective that would actually be very popular and is very intuitive and something that would be easy for people to get on board with. But it gets lost in the polarized way that we talk about environmentalism as an agenda or as an ideology. And, you know, sometimes the ideological environmentalists have a point and they're taking a bold stand to protect something that needs to be protected. But other times it becomes something that, as you described, could be essentially anti-human or pagan in a way that also refuses to acknowledge the way in which nature is a creature. Nature is a creation dependent on even higher powers.
Yeah. It's interesting. All right. So just talking about rights and rights language, right? You'll hear human rights and animal rights and environmental rights and other rights besides. It strikes me that often enough, you know, when describing rights claims, we're trying to lay hold of something that can be leveraged in policy or that can be leveraged in discourse. But when you think about the antecedent conditions, right, like most basically thinking about how St. Thomas Aquinas describes an arrangement of justice, he says that there's a due, like there's something there that lays a claim to our, as it were, engagement, to our respect, to our solicitude, to our stewardship, to our care. And I'm thinking about the way that Joseph Pieper describes how, like, there's always a gift, right, which comes first. There's a sense in which, I come to recognize that I am, you know, a citizen of this country, that I am a son of these parents, that I am a speaker of this language, that I am engaged in these different relationships by virtue of the fact that here I am and here we are. You know, it's like, it's not something that I chose. I didn't establish a social contract. It was just, there's a kind of brute facticity to it. But then the question is, like, how do I live, right? How do I comport myself? So then thinking in terms of justice, obviously we have a lot of resources. I mean, the tradition of discourse on justice is so vast. It's overwhelming. But I'm thinking of like the quasi-potential parts of justice. As St. Thomas says, hey, there's a kind of justice with respect to God, even though, you know, he is in a way wholly other than how we are. Yet we can speak of justice in some meaningful way with respect to religion or, you know, even like truthfulness insofar as we occupy a similar space or we pertain to the same human community. We owe each other the truth. Otherwise, this just doesn't work. So maybe thinking with respect to the environment, what kinds of resources do you discover in the tradition or the body kind of a reflection on justice that, that afford us a kind of entry into that relationship and help us to kind of recognize that gift that goes before us?
Yeah, I mean, justice is rendering things their due, and justice involves recognizing your due place in a larger whole. You know, one of the virtues that we know was very central to classical life and has almost dropped out of discussion except as a kind of inversion of itself, a vice that we think is beneath us, is the virtue of piety. Right? So piety is a part of justice. Typically it's focused on our right relationship with God. So it's considered to be impious to denigrate the gods or not to recognize the gods. But, it, you know, historically talk about piety has extended to any sense of recognizing your dependence on something else and the giftedness of your life because it is dependent on something else. So ultimately, our lives are dependent on God, but we also depend on the social community that we're born into, our people, our nation, our city, in the classical Greek sense, and our families. So there's piety towards your parents. You're not supposed to think of your parents as gods, but there's a kind of God. Your parents have authority. Your parents generated you, and there's an inequality there, so that it's not the kind of justice that pertains between two equal citizens. It's the justice that is harder to exercise because there has to be this recognition that there is this radical dependence. One of Alistair MacIntyre's best titles is his book Dependent Rational Animals. And in a way, I think that's his attempt to, it's not just an attempt to remind us that as rational beings, we are embodied and so physically dependent on other physical things. I actually think it's his attempt to recapture in different language the classical virtue of piety, that we acknowledge our dependence on other things. And that clearly includes the environment. It clearly includes the natural world. It also means that it's never going to be something that we can reduce to a simple decision tree algorithm. It's not going to be a policy that we can impose. We're not going to pass a law that finally settles the question of how to live in a virtue of acknowledged dependence on the environment. And it also means that while Wendell Berry might be a model for many, and he actually has inspired lots of people to try to go back to the land or start a farm, it doesn't mean that you have to be a farmer to start to acknowledge your dependence on the land to produce your food. He's often responded to the question, like, what do you expect us to do? Or are we all supposed to go become farmers? By emphasizing that while he's trying to model a way of life, what he really hopes for is a kind of change of, we might say, mindset or a mental way of thinking about how you live in the world, so that wherever you are, maybe you live in a city and you don't have any historical family land to inherit and you've got to live doing what you're doing right now, but you can still make decisions where you are asking yourself, is this the best way for me to show appreciation for that on which I depend? Is this the best way for me to cultivate virtuous relationships with other people? Is this the best way for me to steward the gifts that I have received? That is a mindset that anybody can be asking and will over time move them towards better relationships with others and better relationships with the land.
Yeah. Okay, so I can understand why people pose that question and why they pose it in those terms. People often pose those questions about all kinds of things, like their sacramental lives, for instance. Like, what am I supposed to do at Mass? It's like, well, not much. I mean, it's prescribed, I suppose, yeah. With the kind of confidence that it's well-conceived and that if you give yourself to it with a modicum of abandon, that it will shape you just well enough to get you over the threshold of heaven. You know, so yeah, I think part of it is, well, maybe I should move on from that thought, because what I'm trying to get to is this idea of like teleology, basically. It seems like implicit within that description, there's a sense of tending or a sense of inclining. Like, we ought to be, you know, healing and growing in some way, shape, or form, because it's clear that we come into this world wounded and weakened, as it were, by choices that have gone before us, choices that are at work in our own members, but that there's a way in which God intends for us to live together and to live on the land so as to facilitate that transformation, that conversion. And I'm thinking about, like, again, like, how do we interact with the environment unto that end? Because I think a lot of people, they hear like a Wendell Berry like solution, as it were, between quotes, and they'll think, well, again, it's a kind of denial, right? It's a kind of fear-driven thing. When Father Vincent McNabb used to kind of make his way around the St. Pancras district of London in the early 20th century, and somebody would ask, like, how do I live? You know, he just like lay hold of them by the shoulders and say, flee the city. So it's like we hear that and it sounds like a denial, but it seems that implicit within it, there has to be an affirmation. Like, there has to be some way of engaging with the land that leads to a genuine flourishing, both for the individual, for his social and political unit, That's so crass. But and then for the land itself, like in Steubenville, when they built the field house, they took local materials, but then they built the field house so it looked like the Umbrian Hills. Like you could see the mark of St. Francis's love for his land, even there in the Ohio River Valley. So I feel like we're kind of all reaching out towards or gesturing in the direction of something like that. But I don't know if you can speak a little bit to that affirmation. Like, what's the affirmation that's going on there?
I mean, the affirmation is that we have received a gift, and the affirmation is appreciating that gift, and the affirmation is especially not only enjoying the gift and using it up, but stewarding it and even ennobling it and enriching it. I guess I'm remaining fairly abstract, but you know, you give the good example of a college campus that has to build something, and you know, you can just hire the most utilitarian contractor to build the building that will technically fulfill your immediate needs. But if nobody on campus is asking, how can this building, lift up souls to think about things beyond its immediate utility? How will this building fit with our history? What story will be told about this building in 100 years? How can we build this building in a way that people will care about it and want to continue investing in it so that it doesn't just fall apart? Now, maybe people wouldn't ask those questions as explicitly as I just did in a podcast conversation. But if you walk on a campus, you can tell the difference between the buildings that were built with those questions in mind and the buildings that weren't. You can feel it in your gut when you walk into those buildings, whether they were built with those questions in mind or whether they weren't. And it makes all the difference to a human community. Buildings that have no soul feel like they suck the souls out of the people who enter them. And buildings that are full of soul feel like they lift and expand our souls and raise them to higher things. Again, that might sound, if not too abstract, too flowery and poetic, but I think I'm capturing something that even people who think they don't care much about architecture would actually recognize. You know, there is a difference between walking into a cathedral and walking into the mall. There are reasons why you experience that difference.
Yeah. Yeah, I think maybe it's in part like, okay, so our engagement with the land, it will go beyond mere cultivation. It will involve some manufacture or artificiality. But we're going to try to do it in such a way that it kind of builds out or extends the logic of the land itself. At the very least, you know, it bears the mark of an intelligence who has sufficiently appreciated the materials with which he is working, and maybe even the kind of gift-like character of those materials. I think in part, you know, the cathedral example is a perfect example because people have very, very different experiences when they enter into very, very different spaces. And oftentimes we don't have the vocabulary or the grammar to describe it with any eloquence, but you know the difference between a church in which you can pray and a church in which you cannot pray, or a church in which you wait for your holy hour to end so that you can flee as soon as possible. I was once assigned to a community, not here in the United States, where the chapel, it felt like a drained swimming pool, and it was savage. It was just brutal, you know? And so it's like, did I develop a kind of affection for it? Yeah. But in the way that you develop a kind of affection for like a rescue dog that has like mange and has 6 of its molars in working condition, but not many more, you know, it's just like, you can look at it and be like, woof, you know, but still, I suppose. And so I'm thinking of, yeah, like our relationship to the environment, without kind of giving in to a mawkish pastoral elegy and just like spinning tales about how sweet it would be to swing on a swing from a low hanging branch on a noble oak and yada yada and thus and such. It's like, like many of us live in cities, or we live in suburbs, and we don't ever, you know, touch grass, as the youths say. But we feel it in our bones that the, like, I'm going to maximize or optimize and toss in AirPods and work on this thing in the background and like that it's going to kill us. You know, we know that. Like, we know that we need to breathe real air. We know that we need to swim in real water. We know that we need to, like, ascend to the heights of real hills, unless you're in a mountainous place, and then get to the mountain, you know. So we recognize that, but, like, we have difficulty translating it. And maybe, like, the answer, like, the virtues help us to translate it in relationship, but it still feels, I think, I suppose, to many as a kind of abstract thing. So maybe along those lines, do you have, yeah, like, kind of encouragements or even resources with which to begin translating? Like, does it mean silence? Does it mean vacation? Does it, you know, like, people will want, yeah, they'll want to know.
Well, just going off your very last comments, I mean, for some people, it might help to get out of your immediate environment that you've taken for granted and extend your vision a little bit. But if you're in a city, just walking a different route and discovering a new part of the city, or going on vacation to get a bigger sense of the world. But I mean, ideally the goal should be to find a way to love something about where you are. And there might be very unlovable things about where you are, but there, you can still find the good. All evil is parasitic on good anyway. So if you think there's an ugly building, you know, you're not going to love the ugliness of the building, but there might be something about it, or something around it, or some opportunity that it still affords you that you can be appreciative for. I mean, I mentioned before the virtue of piety, but I think part of what I was describing in talking about piety was also simply the virtue of gratitude and cultivating a thankful heart. To be thankful isn't just to be kind of blindly cheerful, or to just say to yourself, you know, aren't I lucky? It requires recognizing things as having been received by you, or presenting themselves to you, or as your, or recognizing yourself as having received gifts, maybe internal intrinsic gifts, the very gift of human nature, or the particular talents or opportunities that you have, but also the gifts of your immediate space and your community. And the things around you, the built environment, but also the natural environment. And you know, we're not going to take care of our environment if we're not grateful for it, if we don't give thanks for it. When you travel to places where people there, and there are parts of the world where, you know, it's common just to throw garbage out the window, and there seems to be no care or appreciation for the natural world. It offends us. But it's also just basic, like, lack of awareness, lack of gratitude, lack of acknowledgement of our long-term relationship with the world around us. So again, I'm not offering any policy solutions. I certainly don't have a kind of activist petition for anybody to sign. But I do think that there are ways that. By helping each other to think this way, we can improve the world around us, and also improve our appreciation of the world around us.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a sense in which, and maybe this has been exacerbated by online shopping, sometimes we go out just to get, right? Or we go out just to assimilate. Whereas we, like, I don't know that we're meant to go out just to get. I think sometimes we're meant to go out just to, like, experience, or to revel, or to play, or to, you know, again, I catch myself in the middle of, you know, strings of words, which, if left undisciplined, can sound like sixth grade poetry. But it's just, I don't mean just to give into that in a kind of, like, yeah, silly or saccharine way. But yeah, I just think it's important that there are reasons to leave home which aren't util, and that go beyond the merely pleasant or the crassly pleasant. I think that sometimes we just lose sight of that. Maybe it's just that we get real busy and then overwhelmed by our present duties and obligations. We, you know, come to arrive at the recognition that there's very little bandwidth, you know, to speak in internet-defined terms, very little bandwidth for anything else. But it strikes me that, like, the nature of a gift is that, like, you have to go out in order to welcome it, right? Because we all recognize that it's silly to just like make an Amazon wish list and then just to share that link with your friends and then have them buy for you what you could buy for yourself. Because there's something about a gift that's surprising. There's something about a gift that's, it's like, it's almost revealing to you what you love and didn't realize that you loved because you hadn't thought to buy it for yourself. But on account of the fact that this person got it and crafted it and wrapped it and put a sweet note, you're like, holy smokes, this is exactly what I was hoping for, to be seen, you know, by you. Yeah, so maybe as we kind of come to the end of our time, just a further thought about, this kind of gift-like nature of all of reality, and maybe, you know, to return to the Wendell Berry-like sacramental vision, it seems that if it's a gift, it's a sign, you know, of the giver. Maybe just ways in which we could be attentive to that, ways in which we could be careful in registering that. Yeah, any final thoughts you have?
I think that's really beautiful. Here's how I would put it, which will help us connect again, I think, to some of the power of Wendell Berry's thinking and writing. And I like the example of the Amazon wish list, right? Because that just turns us into parallel consumers who share our interests. And if someone wants to buy something off your list to give it to you, like, okay, then you've fulfilled the desire. That's not gift giving, right? And one of the things that makes it not gift giving is that it doesn't have the same story of a gift. Right, to a gift, we could talk about the metaphysics of gift, but I'm just very practically, if there's a gift, there are two characters, a giver and the receiver. And to give a gift is to play a role with respect to someone else and invite them into a role with you. So just the act of giving a gift is like a little story, a little narrative that gives meaning to the lives of the two people involved around the gift, but the story really isn't about the gift. It's about the giver and the receiver. Why am I talking this way? Well, it's because Wendell Berry is a storyteller. And when I talked about Wendell Berry in a TI talk, I talked about the connection between his thought and Catholic social teaching. But I really do think that a major part of Wendell Berry's effectiveness, and even a part of what is sometimes missing, but isn't totally missing in Catholic social teaching, is that it tells a story about human beings and their history and their relationship with each other and their relationship with God. And, you know, Christianity ultimately isn't a metaphysics. It's a story. It's a story about how God entered into relationship with us and invited him into the greatest story. And so when I say that Wendell Berry is good at having an integrative vision as a philosopher, I often think of integration in terms of, you know, a hierarchy of sciences and tracing things back to their causes, which it is. But he's also integrative in this sense that he sees little stories everywhere that are part of a larger story. And it seems to me that that's what the Catholic vision offers, even when it's trying to instruct, say, on care for the environment, right? That Catholic social teaching at its best is not just applied ethics, but it is applied scripture in the sense of narrating the history of human beings in the circumstances we find ourselves. Catholic social teaching is essentially a response to particular cultural developments, economic, technological complications that are, you know, barely 200 years old. Catholic social teaching emerged as a response to the Industrial Revolution. And it is an attempt to apply moral and political thought to new conditions of scale of human activity and new kinds of human relationships. But it's also an attempt to continue narrating human history as still part of the playing out of God's divine providence. The Industrial Revolution didn't cut us off from the past. It's not like we've entered a new age where there's a different set of rules and we have to talk about ourselves differently. No, we can still see ourselves as somehow however much has indeed changed, we can still see ourselves as in continuity with a story of humankind that has been inhabiting this planet and trying to make a life together under God's providence. So I think, I don't know how well that addresses the particular question that you had in mind, but it seems to me that the idea of the gift is a microcosm of a story, that the point is to ultimately connect it to the greatest story and the original giver.
Yeah, no, I think that's a beautiful way to conclude. And I think that sometimes, yeah, I mean, we all love stories. We can become kind of tired of telling our own story, insofar as we have difficulty sometimes seeing it as something beautiful or something wonderful, whether it's boring or whether it's just too long or whether it's something about which we're embarrassed. You know, it's just like we can have difficulty with that. And I think certainly in the intellectual tradition that I work in, that you work in a lot, there can be a kind of frustration with stories since it's not as nice as metaphysics, you know, since it's not as tidy as metaphysics, because it doesn't admit as easily of systematization, right, or of syllogistic reasoning. But then you have to just come up against the terrible fact that sacred scripture is just about as close as to the flesh of Christ as, like, I mean, basically you got the Eucharist in that. It's just, you know, it's just, you have to lay hold of it, you know, because you know that your salvation consists in laying hold of those things which God gives. And it's just, it's not a metaphysics textbook. It's like, holy smokes, you know? So to have Christ tell the story of salvation, you know, anew and afresh in each of us is something that requires of us the human virtues of hearing any story, but especially the deepest story, you know, that kind of gets down to the deep down freshness things. But yeah, no, that's helpful because I mean, maybe that's in part the response to everyone seeking the way in which to cash it out, or everyone seeking the three-step plan in which to effectuate, you know, this return. But yeah, there's a story to be told, but you have to be content, or you have to be willing to live that story in order to appreciate what comes about in its unfolding, right? In its very telling. So yeah, thanks. Thanks for taking the time. Thanks for thinking about the things and recounting your insights. If people want to follow up with you, presumably, you know, if they were to have questions or things like that, are there particular things that they might read that you've written or ways in which they could be in contact?
Yeah, sure. I do have a kind of personal professional website with links to a lot of my writings and descriptions of some of the publications, joshhochschild.com, JOSHHOCHSCHILD. I know that's a mouthful. Sorry. I'm pretty easy to find online. I do have a Twitter account and try to philosophize on social media. Sometimes successfully, but not always. And I appreciate this conversation, and it's been good for me to even help put some of these ideas together as we're discussing.
Wonderful. Great. Well, thank you. And then turning to our listeners/viewers, thank you for tuning into this episode of the Thomistic Institute podcast. If you haven't yet, please do subscribe, whether on YouTube or on your podcast app, unless you don't want to, and then don't bother. Or if you want to stop listening to the Thomistic Institute podcast, Father Dominic doesn't know this, but that I say this sometimes on these episodes, you should stop listening to it. Because if a podcast becomes a kind of escape from the silence which needs to characterize your life, well then it's an obstacle. So that's all we got for you. Look forward to chatting with you at the next opportunity. Know of our prayers for you. Please pray for us. Until the next time, God bless you.